In 2013, we learned a lot about Mars thanks to the Mars rover Curiosity. It's just one of the top science stories of the year, along with advances in DNA sequencing, a Supreme Court ruling on whether DNA can be patented, and a meteorite explosion over Russia last February. Gemma Tarlak, associate editor of Discover magazine, joins us now to talk about the biggest stories in science and why they matter. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
This year, the Mars rover Curiosity found evidence that Mars may have once supported life. What kinds of things did it find?
Well, first I have to say that the Mars rover story was in our top 10 last year just because of that fantastic nail-biting landing. But this is really the year where Curiosity kind of proved its worth to us. And it found an ancient stream bed and analyzed the material in the stream bed and came up with carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, other building blocks of potentially a life habit. And after that, they started looking around trying to figure out, well, is there any sign of life? And unfortunately, it has not yet detected methane, which could indicate a sign of life. So we're still question mark about the sign of life, but they discovered a lot of data that helps them understand how the environment may have once been habitable.
Well, the rover identified Martian minerals and elements. Are they similar to what we have on Earth?
Of them, yeah. There's a slight difference, and don't know how detailed you want me to get, but in terms of the
you can get detailed. It's okay.
Okay. The isotopes, the versions, basically, of the elements like carbon, they're heavier on Mars than they are here on Earth.
Which leads to greater radiation?
Yeah. And in fact, that was one of the things that came up in the data that is actually going to help us when we do send a manned mission to Mars, is that we're going to have to rethink the shielding. They found out because of the atmosphere and the isotopes telling them about radiation, they're going to need a lot more shielding than they were planning for a manned mission. So they're testing new ways of shielding to protect the folks who go up there from make sure they come back, I guess, is the easiest way to say it.
Well, wouldn't a manned mission take a while? How long does a trip take?
You know, there are a lot of different estimates in terms of how the actual delivery system, so to speak, the vehicle used. But it's going to be a while. So anything from many months to a few years. And they're working on the details of making it more feasible.
Are there still things that scientists are hoping to learn about Mars that they expect to learn about Mars in the coming year?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Curiosity is really just getting started. It's on its way now to Mount Sharp, and it's going to have a look at the exposed rock layers. It'll probably get there. I believe it's scheduled late 2014, early 2015, but it's going to reveal a lot more about whether there was life on Mars, when it might have existed, what kind of life it might have been had it existed.
The second science story of the year chosen by Discover is the Supreme Court's decision that naturally occurring DNA sequences cannot be patented. The case was about the BRCA1 gene. Can you give us some information on what that gene is?
Sure. It's a genetic mutation that's associated with very high risk for aggressive breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And this is a mutation that's been in the news a lot for years now. And the problem was a Utah-based company, Myriad, had patented the sequence containing the mutation, and they kind of had a monopoly on testing for it. So not only were the tests extremely expensive, I think they were about $4,000, but also patients really couldn't get a second opinion. They couldn't get a second test from another company to confirm or show that the gene, that they didn't have that genetic mutation. So this Supreme Court ruling, it's very important for two reasons. Number one, for patients. Almost immediately after the ruling was announced, competitor companies started offering competitor tests. And it, perhaps even more important, is researchers were afraid to do any research on all these patented genes for fear of litigation. And now they're going to be able to really study the genes, figure out, maybe not only just testing for disease, but possibly genetic therapy to cure and treat disease.
So the company that owned the patent was simply holding on to it tight because it was making so much money. Were they not interested in advancing science?
Well, I don't want to speak for the company, certainly.
Well, they must have argued in court.
We know from from the Supreme Court that they have a lot of lawyers on their side. But I think, you know, it's a question of it's not just like you show up one day at the lab and discover a few genes. It is a very long process. It is a very expensive process to identify genetic mutations and other DNA issues. And, you know, from the company's standpoint, they've invested all this time and money. Shouldn't they be protected in some way financially? So that was their take on it. And, you know, this is still, it's not completely settled because there's something called cDNA, and that's basically a lab-made DNA where they take naturally occurring DNA and they edit out the non-functional bits of it. And that, the cDNA, which is widely used in labs, is still patentable. So it's, you know, it's on the done case.
So as long as you have developed something that isn't naturally occurring, you can patent it. Another story that was big news at the time and then seemed to disappear is the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide passing 400 parts per million. I wonder why a story like that disappears, although the obviously the CO2 hasn't disappeared.
Well, actually, it's I think that was a story that it was a nice big round number, and the folks involved were very proactive in issuing press releases. And getting a lot of media attention for it. It was kind of an easy thing to write a story about for, say, just a general audience. But when you started looking at the details, you realized it was really, if anything, a symbolic milestone. And specifically, the 400 parts per million figure occurred at instruments at an observatory in Hawaii in May. And it was not indicative of the global rate. The global rate was actually lower. So it was.
Why would it be higher in Hawaii?
Well, Hawaii is in the northern hemisphere, and this was in May and spring when you're really coming out of the tail end of winter. And in fact, once summer hit and everything got green again and started growing and CO2 levels in the northern hemisphere dropped, the instrumentation on Hawaii also picked up lower levels. So it was just kind of a spike. And we're still increasing the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, and that's still an issue, but it wasn't quite the big deal that was initially made of it. And I think once people started looking at the details, they realized, okay, it's really, you know, in a way, a media event more than a real scientific milestone.
My guest is Gemma Tarlach, associate editor of Discover Magazine. We're talking about the top science stories of the year. They have 100 top stories of 2013 in the current issue of Discover Magazine. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But I want to get back to the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It still is a lot higher than it has been. And don't we know, have some sense of what the concentration was like before the Industrial Revolution?
Yeah, it was significantly lower. I know it was under 350, and it has been climbing. And don't get me wrong, it's not a non-issue. It's a big deal that our carbon dioxide is increasing. And if it gets significantly higher, way above 400, we will have huge issues with the melting of ice, sea level rising, et cetera. But the actual 400 parts per million that was so in the media earlier this year, it's not kind of the tipping point. It's just sort of a sign on the road. Mm-hmm. So it's a
shocking milestone.
Exactly.
The NSA, talk about shocking, the NSA surveillance program is a political story and a security story, but you also see it as a top science story.
We do, you know, and a lot of people have said, what is this doing here? Because we looked at it really as a technology story. And it's kind of fascinating the way, when we look back, we have always been fretful about new technology and how it's going to affect our privacy, whether it was more than 100 years ago, people worrying about the camera, and then even people worrying about data mining in the early 2000s. And so there's always been this battle between technology and the loss of privacy. And I think this really put it into a very clear light for, you know, a lot of us, we go on Facebook, we sign up for newsletters, we enable cookies. We're not really thinking thinking about what privacy, if any, we have when we use technology. And this kind of threw it into a very sharp light for a lot of people.
And we can be tracked by wherever we have carried our cell phone.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, there's so many different ways to get data about us, about what we're doing, our activities, who we're talking to, what we're saying to them. And this is kind of, I think, a wake-up call for folks to realize that this technology is here now. It's not some sort of Orwellian dystopian state in the future. It's here.
And is it just an NSA story, or is it a story about anything that involves the cloud and computer technology?
I would argue it is not just an NSA story. It is really sort of slapping us in the face a bit and saying this is possible, whether it's the NSA, whether it is even, you know, a marketer interested in selling you as product to a company. It's a reality, and we have to decide how we're going to deal with it.
One of the questions that people have been asking is, even if the NSA isn't listening to my phone conversations, what can it learn from the metadata that it's been collecting?
And that's still undecided. We still don't know all the details about it, but there is certainly a wealth of information that they can use in a lot of different ways, whether it be, you know, tracking specifically movements of a group of people or looking at preferences in a geographic region. There are all different kinds of ways they can use the data, but we're still learning about how the data is being used.
And then we have other kinds of things like breaches, as we saw with Target and Christmas shopping.
Yes, yeah. You know, it's I think we all just have to accept that in this electronic age, you know, the bad guys don't wear black hats and walk around six shooters anymore. They are hidden, but they are everywhere, and it is very difficult to be completely secure.
And not just the information that Target would collect, but I gather PIN numbers also were not protected. And I imagine there are lots of people, probably some people haven't even realized that their PIN numbers are no longer private or safe.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that was an incident kind of not related at all to what the NSA is doing, but it's another example of technology being, you know, it's not secure, and for every smart person who comes up with a great way to process credit card information online, there's another smart person who has perhaps more sinister motives of what to do with that information. So we just need to keep vigilant, and you know, don't use your birth date as your PIN. I guess that's my takeaway.
We've been talking about the promise of stem cells for many, many years.
Yes.
Did anything significant happen this past year?
Absolutely. There were so many significant stories that we actually, when trying to address them as a single item in our top 10, we wound up writing three stories just highlighting some of the biggest advances. And the one kind of I'm most excited about is the idea of liver buds. And it's not a new starter course at a restaurant, but it is actually taking adult skin cells and reprogramming them to work more like embryonic stem cells, and then mixing them with other cells and actually creating functioning liver buds with blood vessels and everything. And the liver buds themselves that they were making were less than a quarter inch in size, and you would need tens of thousands of these liver buds to actually replace your liver. But this is a huge deal because in the U.S. alone, you've got more than 16,000 Americans every year needing liver transplants. And I think there are only about 7,000 operations done. So there's a huge disparity. And in some other countries like Japan, where this research was done, it's even worse. For every liver transplant operation in Japan that takes place, there are 10 people waiting for a liver. So this would be a huge development because if you're able to actually grow a replacement liver from someone's skin cell, then you're actually, you don't have to worry about immunosuppressant drugs for the rest of your life because it's your own skin cell, so you don't have to worry about rejection, and you don't have to worry about that awful waiting for months and years for a liver, a donor liver, to be available. So it would be such a breakthrough, and it's actually, they think, maybe in a decade or less, it's going to be a reality, which is pretty exciting to me. So that was one of our stem cell highlights.
Isn't one of the problems preventing cancer from developing when you do this sort of thing? Because you're encouraging these cells to grow and you have to control them, prevent them from growing out of control.
Well, yes, and that's why it's in progress, it's in development. They're obviously going to do a lot of significant testing. I know they're already putting these liver buds into mice, and they're going to continue to test because, you know, cancer, the out-of-control cell growth, that's what cancer is really. It's always a question, always an issue, but to my knowledge, there has been no sign that this is a risk. Of course, they're going to look into that and look at it carefully, but it looks like a very promising technology.
And also, they're growing brain organoids?
Yes. That was another huge stem cell highlight for us. And again, they're taking adult cells and reprogramming them and culturing them, suspending them in gel. It's very sci-fi if you look at the images from the study. And they're actually able to grow them into neural stem cells. And this is further away in terms of actual practical applications than liver buds, as I understand it. But there are two possibilities with this new technology further down the road. First, they might be able to figure out by growing these little brain organoids, as they're called, how certain diseases, such as schizophrenia, happen. And they might be able to figure out a way to even reverse engineer some of the diseases of the brain. And the other thing is, too, we may be able to grow replacement brain tissue at some point, where if you have a traumatic head injury, it may be possible decades from now to have some of your own skin cells taken, cultured, and turned into some replacement brain tissue, some replacement neurons, which would be just a fantastic development. Years away, I want to be clear, it's nowhere near happening right away, but this is such a promising step in that direction.
My guest is Gemma Tarlach, associate editor of Discover Magazine. We're talking about the current issues focus, the year in science, 100 top stories of 2013. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Gemma Tarlach, associate editor of Discover Magazine. We're talking about the top stories in science over the past year. Voyager 1, which was launched in 1977, became the first man-made object to travel into interstellar space. Has it completely left our solar system?
Yes. And we now have the definitive proof. There were a couple false alarms in recent years, but we have definitive proof that it is out of here. It has left our solar system.
And what is the definitive proof?
Well, there are three separate issues that they looked at. First, it recorded a steep drop in what's called the solar wind, which are the stream of charged particles that come from the sun. So that it gives them an indication of how far from the sun it was. And then also, at the same time, there was a huge increase in galactic cosmic rays. Now, these are ultra-fast particles that are coming from outside the solar system. So the drop in solar wind and the rise in galactic cosmic rays were the two first big clues. But the definitive proof really came from measuring the density of the plasma. Now, I think it's been, 30 years maybe, since Voyager 1's plasma sensor failed. And it was near Saturn at the time and just stopped working, so they weren't sure how they would be able to measure the density of the plasma, which also tells them whether or not it's left the solar system. Unfortunately, the plasma vibrations could still be monitored. The Voyager 1 could still monitor the plasma vibrations, and there was sort of a high solar activity, a little bit of an explosion on the sun that kind of rippled out, and the charged magnetic particles hit Voyager 1 in April, and the instrumentation on the craft was able to detect the vibrations and show that the plasma was 40 times denser than previously measured, which told them, yes, it has left our solar system.
Well, considering the fact that it was launched 36 years ago, are we surprised that any of it is still working?
Well, I think it's a pleasant surprise, but not a huge surprise. My understanding is it was given enough power to keep running well into the next decade. So they were certainly thinking very far ahead when they launched it. But it's been a wonder what it's achieved, and to think that it's outside our solar system now, as you said, the first man-made object to venture that far. It's a thrill. I mean, even if you're not a huge astronomy buff, it's a thrill to think that something from our planet, from our hands, so to speak, is really out there beyond our solar system.
It might very well land somewhere else where there possibly is life that would understand what it was all about.
I think that's a little too far. I think that's beyond its bailiwick, as they say.
Okay, I'll scrap that movie idea.
Yeah, right. But, you know, you never know. And just that it's made it this far is a tremendous achievement for the scientists who got it up there in the sky in the first place.
This year, scientists sequenced DNA from ancient bones. How were they able to piece together the genome of a 700,000-year-old horse?
Well, that is kind of a fascinating story in that they had no idea whether they would be able to do it. They found this toe bone in the Yukon in Canada about a decade ago. And the permafrost, where the toe bone of the horse was found, it protects DNA, but DNA still degrades, especially when you're talking about that period of time. So they were able to use a couple new techniques. Basically, instead of sequencing pieces of DNA, they were actually able to go one nucleotide at a time, just building it, very painstaking, very slow, very difficult, but building it up one nucleotide at a time. And the results are actually pretty fascinating because they have found that the common ancestor of horses, zebras, and donkeys, they thought it originated about 2 million years ago. Well, this shows that they're wrong, and it actually originated about 4 million years ago. And they're able to tell that by the sequencing of the DNA.
Now, what is it about toe bones? Because hasn't the complete genome of a Neanderthal woman been sequenced through her toe bone?
You know, it's interesting. A lot of times, just because of when you think of the fossilization process, the skeleton gets spread, it gets, you know, picked over by scavengers, it gets buried, it gets disrupted by geological or hydrological activity. And a lot of times it just seems that the toe bones, the finger bones, the bits and pieces kind of turn up. And it's not anything specific to the toe bone being, you know, a specifically great source of DNA or anything. It's just that happens to be the fossil that was found. And it's interesting you mentioned that about the toe bones, because I have an update to the story in that they found a femur in Spain and were actually able to get DNA out of that femur to obtain the oldest DNA we have ever sequenced from an hominid, an early human ancestor.
That was a Denisovan?
Not exactly. And when we picked the story about the horse toe bone as number 8 in our top 10 for a year in science issue, it was a two-part number 8. There were two stories wrapped into that one entry in our top 10. One of the stories was the horse toe bone, but the other one was a cave bear genome. And the cave bear genome came from a place called Cima de Huesos. It means basically pit of bones. It's a cave in Spain where they have a lot of early hominid bones as well as a cave bear. They wanted to try some new genetic sequencing techniques, and they were a little leery of using the hominid bones because they're so precious. So they started with a cave bear, and they were able to actually sequence the entire genome of the cave bear, 400,000 years old. So once they were able to sequence that, they continued actually trying to sequence an early hominid from that same cave. And it was just December 4th of this year, after our issue had already gone to print, that they released the findings that they had been able to sequence actually the mitochondrial DNA, which is the DNA passed from the mother. They were able to sequence it for this hominid, and they weren't sure what they would find, but they found there was a lot of genetic material related to the Denisovans. Not entirely Denisovan, but certainly more than they were expecting, because the Denisovans, which are a group of early hominids, not really well known. They're known only from basically a bunch of toe bones in Siberia. There are your toe bones again.
So they thought they were all in Siberia and in the Pacific,
in Siberia,
and here they are in
Asia.
Spain.
Yeah, and you know, there's Because they were only sequencing the mitochondrial DNA and not the actual nuclear DNA, that's their next step. But they're not exactly sure how much Denisovan is in there, whether it came from the mother or whether it came from both parents. So they're going to continue sequencing the actual nuclear DNA within the cell, or they're going to try to figure it out. But one of their leading theories is not that this random Siberian Denisovan showed up in Spain. I don't know if he was, you know, on a vacation or something. But they think that there may actually be a common ancestor to the Denisovans and the Neanderthals. They were expecting really to find more Neanderthal DNA. And they think this DNA that they found may actually be a common ancestor of both the Denisovans and the Neanderthals.
And I gather also is a link to diabetes in modern humans. But do we know why Neanderthals and Denisovans lived in Europe and Asia but not in Africa where humans originated?
Well, I think it's a matter of the timeline. You know, as humans moved out of Africa and split up, and, you know, some went east, some went west, that's where the genetic divergence took place, and eventually new species evolved from their common ancestors. And I think it's just a migration pattern, really, that they were expecting to find. So,
in the past 30 years, the rate of obesity among adults has more than doubled. It's tripled among children. But this year, didn't the obesity rate in children go down?
You know, it did. And this is based on the CDC measuring between 2008 and 2011. They looked at the weights and heights of about 12 million children in 40 states and the District of Columbia. And the findings are promising, but they're not kind of knocking it out of the park. Of the 40 states they looked at, obesity rates declined slightly in 18 of those states. Three of the states actually showed increases, and the remaining 19 had no change. So it's not really time to celebrate, but this was the first time they'd see any decline in obesity rates. So this is a good thing, and they're looking at how closely it correlates with updating some of the guidelines, approving groceries, say for the food stamps, to emphasize food, fruit and vegetables. They're looking at public awareness programs like Let's Move, which is First Lady's pet project to get people more active. They're looking at a lot of ways that this may have impacted the decline. I think any decline in obesity rates is great news, especially in preschoolers, but it's not really cause for huge celebration yet.
This year, scientists discovered the biggest volcano on the planet.
Yes.
How was it discovered? Because it's kind of covered, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, I love this story. This was one of my favorites in our entire issue. I was actually able to speak to Bill Sager, who's the geophysicist who made this announcement. And it's a great human story as well as a great science story, because he developed this hunch about 20 years ago. He was mapping the bathymetry, which is basically the underwater, the topography of the seafloor. He was mapping the bathymetry of a place called Shatsky Rise. It's a formation about halfway between, or a third of the way between, Japan and Hawaii. And he started noticing just the shapes and the composition of the rocks. So he started doing sonar using techniques used in commercial drilling. And he just had this hunch that it was not just a volcano, but a single cone volcano. In other words, a volcano with one outlet. And over 20 years, he just kept going back to this volcano, which he named Tamu Massif, and finally got the proof that, yeah, it is actually a single summit volcano. It's not a composite volcano, which is when a volcano has several outlets. It's just one. And
it's extinct, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It erupted 145 million years ago or so, and it is long done. But it left behind just massive lava sheets, 75 feet thick in places, and the actual size of the volcano is larger than the state of Arizona. And it's about three-quarters of the size of Olympus Mons, which is on Mars and is the largest known volcano in our solar system. So this is a big deal. And you know, just speaking with him, it was just so wonderful to hear in his voice kind of like, yeah, I've been working on this 20 years, and finally I've proven it. And it was an exciting moment. And I think it's wonderful that, you know, we think we know so much about our planet already. We think, oh, space is the final frontier. And, yeah, maybe that's true, but there's so much on our planet still to be discovered. So I think this is a wonderful find.
Another major story of the year was the meteorite that broke up over Russia in February. It caused a shockwave that shattered glass, damaged buildings, Why did it explode instead of just falling to Earth?
Well, it was falling to Earth.
Yeah, but it exploded before it landed completely.
Yeah, and, you know, that happens with the bolus. That's kind of the technical term for them. That just happens sometimes. But I think with the story, and by the way, when it exploded, it released the energy of about 30 Hiroshima-style bombs. So it was quite a big deal. But
and this is not the first time this sort of thing has happened over Siberia. Any idea
right,
why there?
Tunguska, yeah. Back in the early 20th century, there was a huge meteor impact in Tunguska. But the amazing thing about this time around was how many people captured it on their dash cams. And, you know, we've got this incredible record of it now just darting across the sky. And I think the other thing, big thing about the story, in addition to the fact that so many people witnessed it and were able to share it immediately through social media, is that it really shows the need for a number of near-Earth object projects that are underway, both government-backed and private, looking at figuring out a way to, you know, decide, is something out there coming its way? Because this is a bit of a surprise. This is a total surprise, really, for us. We didn't see this one coming. So it's kind of reminding people that, yeah, we need to think about this. We need to find a way to know if something like this is heading our way.
The skeleton of Richard III was found in England. How did they know that it's really Richard III?
Well, they started, they went through several steps. They had a checklist. And first, they looked at dating the bones, and they were late 15th century, about 1485. So that told them, okay, that's the right time. They looked at the cause of death, blow to the skull. That was reportedly how he died. They also found the skeleton had severe scoliosis. And we all know Richard III was often referred to as crook-backed. But what really clinched it was they extracted DNA from one of the teeth in the skeleton and sequenced it and compared it to samples from two living relatives, I think 17 generations down the line. And they confirmed it yet that, yes, this was an ancestor of these people who are known to be Richard III's descendants. So by process, sort of going down the checklist, the CSI checklist, so to speak, they were able to say, you know, pretty definitively, scientists hate to be 100% definitive, but pretty with a good deal of confidence that, yes, this is Richard III.
Now, we can't get to some of the other things that you've included. A new strain of the flu was discovered this year, H7N9.
Mm-hmm.
The Centers for Disease Control announced that the actual number of people infected with Lyme disease each year is 300,000, 10 times higher than the official counts.
Yes.
And also, you have written about quantum computing getting real, advancing considerably, and lots of other interesting stories. Is there one that you wish we had talked about?
Oh, gosh. I could talk about this stuff for hours. But I have to say, I was really fascinated by the new coronavirus, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, MERS-CoV is the name of it. And just the science that has gone into tracking this thing since it emerged in 2012. And fortunately, it has not caused any major outbreaks. I think it's killed about 160 people or so, which is unfortunate. But no major outbreaks, no pandemic. And it's fascinating to learn about the science.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. Gemma Tarlak, Associate Editor of Discover Magazine. The Year in Science is featured in the current issue, the January-February issue. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.